When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A member of the DATC media family.
Previously on the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown.
It is the second track and fifth single from the 1992 masterpiece, Fully, Completely. Bill from Kingston, we are talking about Looking for a Place to Happen. What are your initial thoughts about this song?
A little late to the party, falling in love with this track. It wasn't It wasn't the week it was released. It might have been years later. And this is the beautiful thing about the Hips catalog. You know, good luck picking your 10 favorite Hip songs.
Right.
Problem with that is it changes, constantly changes. There are new songs that you know, I'm on a Pigeon Camera kick right now. And to me, it's one of the greatest songs they've ever done. But it didn't really register the first time I heard it. It wasn't until years later, and this is the beautiful thing about their catalog, like I said, is you catch moments of brilliance in every song.
So the chemistry set. Hey, it's JD here, and I'm ready to go. The Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown is now underway. Week over week, we're going to count down the 40 essential tracks by the Hip that you selected with your very own top 20 ballots. I then tabulated the results using an abacus and a Pentium 3-powered Malarkey Wagon. You should also meet Malachi, the Malarkey Wagon's newest feature, AI. How will your favorite song fare in the rankings? You'll need to tune in every week to find out, so there's that. This week, I'm joined by the Tragically Hip superfan, Tyler from Etobicoke. How the hell are you doing on this haptastic day, mister?
I am doing well. It is good to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for doing this. You do all the heavy lifting here. This is a breeze for me. I love these podcasts.
Excellent. I am ready to lift some heavy things.
All right.
Enormous things, in fact.
Oh, perfect. Well, let's start at the start. Take me through your Tragically Hip origin story or your hip story.
Sure. Yeah. So I think the first song I ever heard by the Hip was New Orleans is Sinking. I think it was being played on Much Music. I was at my friend Dave Schroeder's house in Stony Creek, Ontario. Beautiful Stony Creek, Ontario. And I remember him being very excited about it and watching it with him and thinking, yeah, that's cool. But it didn't really stick with me. I didn't immediately run to Sam's and pick up to here. I was just like, yeah, that's a cool song. And then I just kind of forgot about it. The Hip didn't really connect with me until the summer of 1991. I was attending summer school, my everlasting shame, because I failed grade 12 math. I was not a good math student. And so I was taking the GO bus in from Burlington every day to attend Scott Park High School right by Iverwin Stadium, the dear departed Iverwin Stadium. Scott Park's not there anymore. It's been leveled, probably for the best. And one day after summer school, I was downtown Hamilton and I was in Cheapies Records and Tape. Also,
I remember Cheapies.
The dear departed Cheapies.
Yeah.
And I bought two albums, I believe, one of which was Into the Great Wide Open by Tom Petty. And the other was Road Apples on cassette.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And so I remember sitting on the GO bus and popping in Road Apples and just being absolutely riveted. And I listened to the Petty album a fair bit, but I listened to Road Apples every morning on the way in, every afternoon on the way home. I could not get enough of it. And from then on, I was hooked.
So what prompted you to make that purchase?
I honestly don't remember. I don't know if it was a whim or if I'd been talking about it with my friends, but whatever it was, I grabbed it and I never looked back.
Yeah, it was the first CD I ever bought.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I didn't even have a CD player yet. I knew I was getting one, and I knew what I wanted to christen the CD player with, and it was the Tragically Hip, for sure.
That's an excellent choice. I'm sad to say that the first CD I ever owned was a compilation. I believe it was a Columbia Records compilation called Hard and Heavy, which had, really? Among other things, Frankenstein by the Edvard Winter Group. It had, I think, Ted Nugent. There was a Ted Nugent song on there. Might have been Cat Scratch Fever. So that was the first CD, wow, I ever owned. I didn't buy it. I think somebody gave it to me with the CD player that I got for Christmas that year.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A classic.
Columbia House, bringing back memories.
Yes.
So where do we go from there? You spend a summer with Road Apples. Definitely a great summertime companion.
Yeah.
Where do we go from there as we roll into the fall in grade 13, presumably?
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually going into grade 13. And, you know, Road Apples stuck with me. The next album I got, obviously, was Fully Completely, which was the next one that came out. I didn't get that till, that was the first hip album I had on CD. My good friend Derek Ma gave that to me for Christmas in 92, I guess. And the thing that I regret constantly is that I didn't see them live until 98. Okay. I was not, for whatever reason, I was not a big concert goer in my sort of late teens, early 20s. I just didn't go to concerts, and I don't, for the life of me, understand why, because I love concerts. I love them then. It didn't occur to me that it was a thing I could do. Like, I was an only child, so I didn't have like the influence of a sibling to say, like, check out this music or go to this show. Right. It was kind of my own weird winding journey where I was sort of listening to my parents' music for the longest time. Like, the first concert I ever went to was actually Barry Manilow.
Get out of here. You said that in the chat the other day, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I was a huge Barry Manilow fan when I was 6 years old. I would like bring in Barry Manilow songs to show and tell and like lip sync to them. And I should have been
amazing.
I should have been severely bullied as a child, but somehow I wasn't.
But that voice kept the bullies at bay.
Oh yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I didn't get a chance to see them until the Phantom Power Tour in 1998.
Great record to see them on.
It was a fantastic tour, but you know, I cruised through many albums and you know, I bought them the day they came out, Day for Night, Trouble at the Hen House, bought them, absorbed them immediately. But it wasn't until 98 when I was working, I was in a relationship, and a good friend of mine said, hey, the Hip are playing in Albany, New York. So what do you think? We take a road trip down there. We got two other couples together. We got a shitty hotel in Albany that I recall being right next to the expressway. Like the cars were inches from the hotel room. and we saw them at, the Palace. I believe it was Thanksgiving weekend of 1998. In Albany, New York, and it was a fantastic show.
What kind of venue was it?
It was like a small-ish theater, like maybe 1,000 seats, not huge. And you know, probably 80 to 90% Canadians who had made the trip down, as were many of those sort of New York State shows,
right.
But it was fantastic. And I recall, the Gord stopped the show right before the encore because somebody was crowd surfing and whacked their head on the edge of the stage.
Ooh.
So that was that.
He was a great lighthouse for that front
few
rows of people. He always was looking out for them.
Yeah, he really was. And yeah, he just was like, okay, that's enough tomfoolery. Good night, everybody. Which I think was probably the right call. Yeah, I remember they did not do an encore.
Damn.
Yeah, yeah. I think they played 18 or 19 songs. I mean, I still loved it and felt like I got my money's worth. But yeah, it was kind of a shitty ending to a great show.
Any highlights you remember other than that low light?
Obviously just seeing the band in person was just mind blowing for me, having, you know, listened to them for seven years at that point, them having been in my ears for that long and that consistently. You know, and see, like, the big songs like Poets and Fireworks and Bob Cajun were just, you know, they just sounded, they were really at their peak, I think, on that tour. And it was a real experience for me. The Watchmen were the opening band, and they were fantastic as well. They actually stayed at the same hotel as us, so we saw them at breakfast the next morning, which was exciting.
That's so wild.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they stayed at the shitty hotel. I'm sure the Hip had slightly better accommodations in Albany.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, Albany being the crown jewel of New York State.
It's capital. It's beautiful, especially in the fall.
Are you being sincere or no?
No, I'm not being sincere.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, well, Albany's. I have nothing bad to say about Albany. If anyone
that's right.
is listening from Albany, I have no beef with your town. It's a lovely place.
That's right. Mimico will not be facing off against Albany anytime soon.
That's right. That's right.
Yes. So where do we go from there? Once you see them live, does that break a floodgate and you start to see them live
a little
more
bit.
Often?
So okay. yes and no. So I saw them 6 times total.
That's a great number. Yeah.
It's pretty good. I mean, I curse myself for not having seen them at least twice that many times. You know, I saw them after that Albany show. I saw them again. It was still the Phantom Power Tour at the ACC in Toronto in February of 99. So it was the first weekend that the ACC opened. There were 2 Hip shows.
Wow.
And then I think the Leafs played maybe the next night or something like that. I can't remember if I'm getting that right, if the Leafs played first and then their Hip shows or if it was vice versa, but they were the first shows at the ACC.
They were definitely the first concert at the ACC.
Yeah.
I don't know, like you, whether or not it was before or after the Leafs game, but they were definitely the first band to play. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's special.
So that was great. That was great. And then I saw them again on the Music at Work tour. I saw them in Rochester, New York. Again, it was like this weird
little... I was
going
to say, did you see them at Massey?
No,
played Massey in Toronto for that.
Yeah, I never saw them at Massey. We were at this weird little... It almost felt like a high school auditorium in Rochester. It was a very strange venue, but it was a great show.
You love your upstate New York venues.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It was the same friend actually who had suggested the Albany show. He just liked taking road trips to New York, I guess. And then also on that tour, I saw them in Hamilton at Cops Coliseum. And I remember that show being extremely happy that they played Opiated from Up to Here because I always loved that song.
I don't know that I ever heard them play that. I'll have to look it up on my set list.
I don't think they played it that often, but
no.
That was definitely a highlight of that show.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah, so do I. And then after that Cop show, which was, I believe, spring of 2000, I didn't see them again until 2015.
On the Day for Night tour? Yeah.
The Fully Completely...
Fully Completely tour. That's right. I said Day for Night, but I meant Fully.
Yeah. And I don't know why. It's not like I fell out of love with the band. You know, I went through some stuff. Like, I had a kid in there, so that kind of kept me off concerts for a while. I got divorced in there, so that also kind of kept me off concerts for a while. I didn't see them. I think there was a time kind of maybe following We Are the Same in that sort of late 2000s period where it's not that I didn't love the band, but I was certainly kind of exploring other musical options, and they were just kind of there for me. They weren't something I was like, yeah, like I gotta go see them. And again, I you know, I do regret that because I think I missed out on some excellent shows, but that's, you know, that's just the way it goes.
Were you still buying records on the day they came out during that?
I bought every single one of them the day they came out.
I don't know that I did well, after In Violet Light, in between Evolution,
really?
I did not, for sure.
Yeah.
I won't bore anybody with my thing, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it was all the way until Greg turned me on to Now for Plan A, probably 5 years after it came out.
Oh, really? So had you sort of parted ways with the Hip entirely during that period?
Similar to you, it was a fallow period. Like, it was just, you know, it was like I listened to things here and there, but in no way was it the same as in my in my early 30s and 20s, and high school for that matter. Yeah, like I was.
And I think part of that is just, you know, the age and stage thing. Like when you're in your late teens, early 20s, you've got all the time in the world to go deep on music and bands that you love. And then as you get into your late 20s, early 30s, you start having, you know, career responsibilities, family responsibilities, and the time you have to spend on kind of digging deep on music is those times are few and far between.
Now, there's an interesting confluence that has been revealed through the docuseries, and that is that the band themselves weren't that impressed or blown away by their output during that period. So you get that combined with the fact that the cohort of, you know, the main cohort of their fans being Gen Xers were all going through that period at that time, give or take. And it did lead to an incredibly fallow period. Now, I know there are diehard Hip fans that didn't waver and continued to see them and saw them hundreds of times. But that was not me, unfortunately. And I, like you, have regret.
Yeah, no, exactly. But, you know, we all have to make choices, and I don't regret the choices I made, but I do wish I had seen them a few more times in that period. And it's not like I don't like those albums. I like them very much. But yeah, it was just the way the universe was working and speaking to me at that time, it just wasn't happening.
Tyler, I think for me it was a wonderful mistake that I made. And, you know, to quote Gord, why search for perfection when you're making successful mistakes? And my successful mistakes were, you know, not listening to several records in the catalog at the time of. But the benefit of that is in my 40s, I've got to explore all this music that I wasn't overly familiar with. And I've done that with you all through these podcasts. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we've all benefited from that. Certainly from hearing you and the various co-hosts that you've had on your podcasts. It's allowed us to kind of look back and maybe find some things that we didn't find the first time around, and kind of re-examine our love of the early stuff too. So that's been really exciting for me.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, So do you have like a go-to record at this point? Is there something that you'll put on like record-wise? Yeah, you know,
it really varies. And I still kind of go through periods where, I go through periods where I don't listen to the Hip at all. And then I come back to them and I listen exclusively to the Hip for a couple months at a time. It's kind of feast or famine that way. There are really, you know, probably five or six records that I would put on a regular basis. Day for Night is probably the one that I go to the most, just because I love so many of the songs on that album. And it really, for me, kind of holds together as a full statement, like an end-to-end, no skip classic album.
And it takes you back too, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like I was in university when that came out. There was just so much exciting stuff going on in my life. And it was really, it really does take you back to being 20 years old again. But I could definitely make a case for at least half a dozen of their albums, and even the ones that don't make that case, I still put on fairly regularly. So it's, they have a really spectacular catalog with, you know, I don't think there's a dud in it, you know, even the EP. It's not something that I go back to often, but there are some really special songs on that as well. So they're a unique band in that way that you don't look at an album and say, "Oh man, that was a real dud."
No, I agree. Like even when I first listened to We Are the Same, I thought it was very beige, and now I listen to it and I'm like, "What was I thinking? What was I thinking? This album is rich. This album is, you know." But again, then watching the documentary and you hear that it's not even really like a band album, you know, that's troubling to me a little bit.
It is. It really kind of makes me reconsider those albums. And again, not in a negative way, but it just helped me kind of understand why they sounded the way they did and kind of why those songs came out in the way they did. Right. You know, the, I for me, there's kind of a stopping period. And I think one of the guys in the band, I can't remember who even said it in the documentary, that Phantom Power is kind of the end of the classic hip period, right? Like,
yeah.
Everything from the EP up to Phantom Power is kind of in that range. And then
that's right.
Music at Work still has elements of classic hip, but they have started to go in a different direction. It's around the same time as Gord's writing his solo stuff. So he's exploring some new areas. They bring in Kate Fenner and Chris Brown, who, as we learned from the documentary, the band was not thrilled about. Not that they don't like Kate and Chris, but it just changed the dynamic of the band.
Sure.
And then every album from then on is really a departure from that original sound. And I think a departure from the album previous. There aren't really many through lines that connect those last albums. Maybe the Bob Rock albums are a little bit more connected, just sonically. But it's really interesting to go back and look at those later period albums to see kind of where the band was at, what their relationship was with Gord, what their relationship was with each other. And it's a really interesting exercise, especially now that we have seen the documentary and have the insight that the band provided us with to show us that, you know, maybe things weren't that great with the band dynamic.
That was so crushing watching that, because you just, you know, really our whole lives we've grown up that these guys, they throw around the word brothers, and it's the perfect term, really, because I guess I was just taking it in the positive sense the whole time. But with family, we do have conflict, and you know, and it's okay. You work through that conflict and you become stronger.
Yeah. And I mean, I think as the documentary showed, their bond was strong enough that they were able to work through that stuff and kind of have it out. And, you know, Gord was, it's so funny because Gord on his own, his solo stuff, which I love, Gord would probably have, well, maybe not a hard time filling the horseshoe, but he would have a hard time filling Massey Hall, let's say, with a solo tour. Whereas the band could fill the Rogers Center, like Taylor Swift style, you know, like the.
How about Rogers Stadium though? Could they sell out that?
I bet they could if you know, assuming it gets built. We'll see. but where was I going with that? I guess you know, we saw that the band dynamic, and Gord was kind of off on an island because he was exploring his own stuff. He was working with other musicians. And the rest of the guys in the band were like, well, hey, what about us? You know, what, aren't we a band? Aren't we still doing this? It really is something very, fascinating to look back and again, see those albums through that lens.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, definitely agree. Well, should we look at the song of the week through a different lens?
Let's do it.
All right, we'll be back right after this to talk about this week's song.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Hey, this is Paul Langlois from the Tragically Hip saying hello. Now on with the countdown.
34. Lost in the happens. Don't you wanna see how it ends?
That's right, today we're revealing a standout on the Hip's 11th studio long play, We Are the Same. Today's song is the absolutely gorgeous The Depression Suite. Tyler from Etobicoke, what are your initial thoughts about this song when you first heard it?
Yeah, so, I mean, this album, We Are the Same, is such an interesting part of their catalog. You know, we talked about the Bob Rock albums a little bit in the previous segment, and it, you know, sonically it's a very, you can hear the hallmarks of Bob Rock. If you've heard any other Bob Rock albums that he's produced, there are certain hallmarks that you can hear, the way the drums are tuned, the way the mix is done, the where the focus is at any particular time. So those two albums, World Container and We Are the Same, really kind of stick out a little bit in the catalog as being separate from everything else and kind of their own little chapter. We Are the Same is probably my favorite late period album. There are just so many songs on it that stand out for me. And I think part of it is the lyrics that Gord's writing at that time. They're very personal. They're very introspective. And they really kind of resonate with me. I'm very much a lyrics guy when I listen to music, and those songs, those lyrics really connected with me the first time I heard the album. And I think, yeah, and the Depression Suite for me is just such a beautifully crafted, multi-part story that has probably the broadest scope of any Tragically Hip song. And we'll get into some of the intricacies of that in a minute. But the first time I heard it, I think it really almost, it startled me because it was so different from anything else the band had done to that point. And since, really, there's nothing else like it in the catalog. So I remember hearing it, and I remember thinking, man, that is, I wasn't sure if I liked it, but it was, right. it really caught my ear as something very, very different.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too. Just it's the longest song in the catalog.
Yeah.
So 10 minutes. Right away, it stands out just, you know, before you even put the needle on the record, you're looking at the liner notes and you're like, wow, 9 minutes or 8 minutes and change. Yeah. This is substantial. I wonder what is contained within, and then you lift the lid and you get all those for lack of a better word, goodies. What do you think of those segments in the song, the way it's broken down, and you know, that good stuff?
Yeah, no, it's again very a very unique composition of the song, and you know, reading about it, Bob Rock had suggested they take three different songs that were sort of on the table for the album and combine them into one. According to Gord, Paul Langlois had suggested these particular song to be used. And there's three songs that make up the suite. So the first part is called The Rock. The second part is called New Orleans World, which again, Gord loves going back to New Orleans. And the third part is called Don't You Want to See How It Ends.
Oh, my fire alarm is going off. Sorry.
Oh, good timing.
Give it one second. I don't know how long it's going to go off for. That never happens. Do you remember where you were?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. You were talking about The Rock.
Yeah.
In New Orleans. And then New Orleans. Yeah.
Yeah. The
breakdowns. Okay, it stopped. So.
Okay.
I don't know what that was.
Yeah, weird. Okay. Should I just start that part over?
If you would, please.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. yeah. So, according to Gord, Paul Langlois had suggested these particular songs be the ones that they combine into this one song. So, The Rock is the song that they used for the first part. The second song was New Orleans World, which again, Kurt loves going back his New Orleans references. And the third part is Don't You Want to See How It Ends? There is a through line that connects these songs. So if Paul Langlois was thinking lyrically that these were the three songs that should fit together, he made an excellent choice.
I agree.
And lyrically, you know, again, this album is feels very, very intimate and introspective. We know now that the band is going through some real struggles. I'm not sure how tuned into those struggles Gord was at the time, though, because he and Bob Rock seemed like they were sort of off on their own island doing their own thing. And the rest
literally,
of the band,
they're on Maui, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. And the rest of the band was kind of sitting there going, okay, what's going on with this album? So Gord's lyrics are very, very personal, very, very introspective. And Gord has also said that Bob Rock, he viewed Bob Rock almost as like a coach or a guru of sorts. I think Bob Rock really pushed Gord, lyrically. I think he pushed him as a musician and a vocalist. But again, you know, so I think those things really helped Gord, and I think the album benefits from it. But obviously the band, felt the impact of that isolation. The interesting thing also is that they only ever played it, in concert on that We Are the Same tour in 2009. So I think they played it like 82 times, but only in 2009, never again.
Wild.
Yeah. Yeah. You would think a song like this would have made its way back into the catalog, at least even for the farewell tour. But, only in 2009.
Wow. Okay. I wonder, it just makes you wonder the alternate universe where, you know, glioblastoma isn't a thing. And Gord is still around. It just makes you wonder how many of these songs would have become live staples or live classics, you know, over the years that it takes to marinate, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. And I think this is one that would have made its way back around. Because I think there is a segment of the fan base that really gravitates to this song and sees it as something special. I think there are a lot of Hip fans that probably hate this song because it's very, very different from anything else that the Hip has done. And it's also very long, and some people just don't like long songs, which fair enough.
Well, it could come off as indulgent, I suppose, but it's so earnest that it's hot.
Is. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The way that Gord kind of spins this tale of, I think it's a tale of depression. I mean, the title says it, but the scale of the song is really, I think, what sticks with me. It's such a grand sweeping tale that I couldn't help but be drawn into it.
Yeah, you do become, I mean, it's long enough that it envelops you like a blanket. You can wrap yourself in it and really get caught up in the lyrics. I know as somebody who struggles with mental health, I found myself listening to it and being a lyrics guy as well, listening to it and really, really digging in on those lyrics and having them resonate in my bones, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a song that I go back to if I'm having kind of a hard time. I like to not necessarily wallow in it, but I like to hear songs that are kind of speaking to me and how I'm feeling in that moment. And this is certainly one that I go to when I'm not feeling my best.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I can see that. There's an emotional through line in the song as well that it almost would take you through a spectrum of emotions through the song, like from feeling sad and melancholy to ultimately being sort of, you know, the final chorus, Don't You Want to See How It Ends, is somewhat uplifting the way it's sung, right?
That's exactly how I see it too. I think it's a tale of depression in three acts. I think it examines the feelings of depression through the lens of some very common human reactions to the experience of depression. I think it starts at a place of avoidance. It moves to a place of kind of stoicism and quiet reflection. And then it ends on kind of a note of hope and a little bit of a glimmer of light for the future, which is why by the end of it, I feel good about things again, because, you know, it's I've been able to kind of sit in my negative feelings for a while. And then by the end, kind of draws out the hopeful side.
Oh, that's lovely. I think that's absolutely fucking great. Yeah. So is there anything else you want to say about the depression suite, Tyler?
Well, yeah, there are a few things I'd like to say about it.
Please do.
You know, I wanted to dig in a little bit on those three topics, because I think they're really important to examine. Act one for me, The Rock, it's again about avoidance. It's someone, the narrator is kind of paralyzed, feeling paralyzed by their depression and just kind of wants to avoid everything. You know, they're burying their head in the pillow. They're finding some comfort in being kind of locked away in their bed. And he's hearing some sounds in the environment that to him feel like empathy, like, you know, are you going through something? The sound of the siren, the sound of the bustle outside, what he's hearing from that is, are you going through something? And so he's feeling like the world, even though he's feeling kind of isolated and depressed and wanting to avoid everything and everyone, he's feeling some empathy from his environment, and it causes him to maybe sort of reach out to someone else in his life, a loved one, to ask them the same question, are you going through something?
Wow. Yeah. Okay. I like that idea of the sounds representing the question, are you going through something? I think that's a really astute observation, Tyler from Etobicoke. Nice.
Thank you. See, this is me going back to my English student roots and, you know, let's do a really close read on this poem and tell me what it's about. Let's write an essay about it. Right. So this was kind of the exercise I went through.
So that takes us to act two.
Yeah. Act two, New Orleans world. So again, Gord has gone back to New Orleans so many times. Obviously New Orleans is sinking. If New Orleans is beat, you know, the band's not, they didn't start out in New Orleans, but they recorded some of their early work there. And it's clearly an important place for Gord. It's a place with a lot of mystique, a lot of history. But he's also put the narrator of this section in a very boring setting. And the way I read the lyrics, it seems like he's a worker in a windowless casino or some kind of environment like that. Like, it's very boring, very sterile. But as he's going through this job, he's dreaming. He's thinking about what else is there in the world? What else is there out there for him? And I think what that thing is for this narrator is being a songwriter. And the question that he poses to himself, you know, I think it's the song or the question that every dreamer asks themselves is, what if this song means nothing? Like, what if I do this? What if I follow my dream and it has zero impact? What if nobody cares? What if nobody listens? So he's going about his workaday job and dreaming, but at the same time thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't, because maybe it'll just end up being nothing.
That sounds remarkably similar to somebody who might be procrastinating and
absolutely.
And I mean that deep procrastination that comes with depression and anxiety. I don't necessarily mean, oh, I should do this later, but, you know, the narrator of this song is really, that's really powerful to think of them as putting something off that they're dreaming about because it might not mean anything.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of the fear of success and the fear of failure all wrapped up in one. And you're exactly right. Like, I think anyone who has struggled with those feelings of depression or procrastination has gone through that, thinking, well, you know, I could do this, but what would be the point? You know, what if I do this? What if I invest all this emotional energy in it and it just falls flat on its face?
Okay. Well, we're good now because you finished the thought. I don't know why this is doing this. Normally this is on Wednesdays. Really
weird. Oh, really?
And I don't. Yeah. They do the last Wednesday of the month, but this is not even close to that. Okay. It just went once again. I don't know what's happening. So this takes us, this, was that the end of Act 2?
That's the end of Act
3 now? Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
so let's go to the final act, Act 3, where I'm really curious to see how you put this together, because there's a couple of phrases in this and this one that throw me right off the trail.
Yeah, there is some ambiguity, let's say, in the lyrics in this final section. And I spent a long time thinking about it and trying to make sense of it. And I have a theory, but I there's some of it that's just like over my head, and I can't even get into Gord's psyche for this stuff. But I think in this third act, our narrator, and I'm not sure if this is the same narrator through all three pieces or if it's three different people. I don't think it matters that much. I think it's three vignettes that could be connected. Certainly connected emotionally. But our narrator in this third act is a frontiersman, and it seems like he's in Fort McMurray, or as he refers to it, Florida without the ocean. and he's pondering the Canadian dream, you know, moving somewhere that's full of promise, establishing himself, being the man on the moon, finding his little slice of heaven. But it's a struggle between settling for that or continuing to push for something more. And the question that he repeats over and over is, don't you want to see how it ends? Which to me feels like he's asking himself, shouldn't I keep going? Shouldn't I keep pushing and not settle for this? Isn't there more than this? And for me, this part of the song is about that feeling of when you're coming out of a feeling of depression and you find a little bit of hope, a glimmer of light, in a choice, and you're able to find the courage to bet on yourself and to feel comfortable in your ability to move forward. And I think it's a really powerful message. And it's something, again, that, you know, when I'm feeling down and I listen to this song, this is what kind of pulls me out and says, yeah, like, you know what? I can do this. I can push myself forward. I don't have to be stuck here in this mire. I have the ability to move past this.
I really appreciate the optimism in your reading of that final, because it could be, you know, you could read it very, sadly, I suppose, you know, like it could be like that this person is, you know, ready to take their life by suicide, ready to die by suicide. And, yes, you know, they're having that inner monologue. Don't you want to see how it ends? But I really like the optimism in your telling of it, because it does tie into that feeling that we all have when we listen to the song of hopefulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the first several times that I listened to it, that negative reading of, you know, I think maybe he's considering killing himself, is how I saw it. But the more I kind of listen to it and look deeper into the lyrics, I think it is a message of optimism and hope. You know, and I was looking also for literary inspiration for this part of the song, because of the three segments, this feels the most literary. And as we know, Gord drew a lot of inspiration from literature and poetry. Mm-hmm. He makes a reference to Farley Mowat, Lost in the Barrens. And he talks about Athabasca, and Athabasca is a place in Alberta. It's south of Fort McMurray, but there's Lake Athabasca, and it's been used in writing, in particular by a Canadian poet named Robert Servais. And he has a poem called The Man from Athabasca. And he doesn't, Gord sometimes would draw almost verbatim from poetry. He doesn't do that here, but there is the last verse of The Man from Athabasca kind of speaks to, I think, what Gord's going for here. So I'll read that last verse. For I've had my fill of fighting, and I've seen a nation scattered, and an army swung to slaughter, and a river red with gore, and a city all a smolder, and as if it really mattered, for the lake is yonder dreaming, and my cabin's on the shore, and the dogs are leaping madly, and the wife is singing gladly, and I'll rest in Athabasca, and I'll leave it nevermore. So I think, you know, I don't know if that was on Gord's mind when he wrote this. It certainly wouldn't surprise me. But I think for the narrator, the idea of Athabasca is settling, as it is in that poem. These people were literally, and that when I say these people, I mean people who were sort of original pioneers and settlers out west, but even the people now who have gone to Fort McMurray to kind of work in the oil fields. You know, these people are literally settlers. And he's pondering the cost of staying in place versus seeing how it ends and pushing forward. So, again, I don't know if there's a connection to that poem, but I found something kind of very, the settling side of things in that poem versus the pushing forward that Gord speaks of.
Yeah, I like the Gordian read of that. That is very well done.
Thank you.
Gordian read. Anything else about the Depression Suite? This gem of a fucking song.
And
by all rights, it shouldn't be. It comes from this record that is, you know, in some ways divisive among the Tragic Lit fans. It's Bob Rock. It's got, you know, gang vocals, it's got strings, it's got, there's just a lot of stuff that should make it not work, and yet it works beautifully.
It does. Yeah, I love the song very much. And I think, and we talk about the Bob Rock sound, I don't even really particularly like the Bob Rock sound. To me, it sounds a little over-engineered.
It does. It seems almost, sterile sometimes.
Yeah, sterile. We can't do this, but it would be interesting to hear what this album would have sounded like with a different producer. But obviously that opens up a whole other can of worms of would we even have gotten the song with another producer, and probably not.
I wish they had worked with Steve Berlin for the remaining part of their career, because it seems like he really understood them and got a lot out of them.
I agree. You mentioned the gang vocals, and one of the things in the documentary again that they talked about was the fact that Gordon Bob are off doing their thing on Maui. And then they brought in Paul Langlois and Gord Sinclair to do vocals, I think, on two or three songs. And I assume this was one of them, because you can hear them on the third act doing just, I think, personally, some of their most beautiful background vocals. Just really gorgeous, those ah-ahs in the chorus. Yeah. Clearly they were going through something, because, you know, they were not sure what their involvement in the album was really going to be beyond, you know, just playing on the songs. It certainly was less than it would have been on any of their previous albums. So.
Well, Sinclair's disdain is palpable in the doc when he says, I've never been fired from a job until now. And it's from my own fucking band.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. But so I don't know if it's my favorite Hip song. There are certainly others that I probably go to more often or would mention before I mention this one, but it's up there. And it's probably the one that I've spent the most time thinking about, trying to kind of peel apart and understand. And it's really just the scope of it. It's such a different, grand, unique set of stories or vignettes that just, I think, tie together so beautifully. So it's one that I will always love.
Well put. Tyler from Etobicoke, do you have anything you would like to plug?
Do I have anything I'd like to plug? Not really.
A quarterly podcast.
Yeah, quarterly. I appear on the Toronto Mike podcast with my good friend Cam Gordon and Toronto Mike. And we do a thing called FOTM Cast, which is a look back at the previous quarter of shows of the Toronto Mike podcast. So if you are a listener of Toronto Mike podcast, I recommend that you check out FOTM Cast. If you're not, I would probably not start with FOTM Cast because it's
a deep dive
meta, and you probably will listen to 5 minutes of it and say, what the hell is this? So, quarterly, check it out.
Thanks so much, Tyler. And that's what I've got for you today on this, the 7th episode of the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown. As usual, subscribe, share, rate, and review the podcast. Tell your friends. Let them in on the fun. Thanks for stopping by. Pick up your shit!
Thanks for listening to the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown. To email us, send an email to tthtop40@gmail.com. We're social. Find us on all the socials at tthtop40.
Tuvra! Podcasts and such.
The Christ Hospital Health Network and Premier Health, named top hospitals in Cincinnati and Dayton by U.S. News, have joined forces to deliver specialized cardiovascular care to the community. This partnership gives you access to leading experts and advanced treatments for complex heart conditions close to home. With expanded services and cutting-edge technology, we're doing everything it takes to provide world-class heart and vascular care together. Learn more at premierhealth.com/together.